probably all began when old man Bell started seeing an odd-looking animal on his farm. Something half rabbit, half dog. Queer-looking creature. And then, late one night, the crashes began. Noises rattled across the house. And a voice from the darkness told the family terrible things. The Legend of the Bell Witch, next on Monster Talk.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm your host, Blake Smith, and together with Ben Radford and Dr. Karen Stolzner, we dig into monster stories to find out what truths we can and what facts there are. Today we discuss the Bell Witch Haunting, a strange story from the 1800s in Tennessee, which includes an amazing array of paranormal events and some famous people, including Andrew Jackson. Before we go on with that, I want to take a quick moment to tell you about an important project that's going on right now. I'm recording this intro on January 22nd. It's the birthday of quack cancer treatment guru Stanislaw Brzezinski. Brzezinski's expensive and ineffective treatments deplete the fiscal and emotional resources of desperate cancer patients. A group of concerned skeptics are trying to raise awareness of this and support effective cancer research at the same time. Please take a moment and go to crowdrise.com/fightchildhoodcancer. I'll put a link in the show notes as well. This fundraiser is part of a joint effort of many people in the skeptics community and is a worthy cause. Thank you. Today's Monster Talk interview comes from October and has been delayed due to a series of ridiculous technical issues, but here it is, and I hope you enjoy it. The Bell Witch.
Monster Talk.
You're a little faint.
Am I? Okay.
There you, that sounds better. I don't know if you leaned in or whatever.
Oh, I just leaned in. That's exactly what I
did. It's high-tech stuff.
Very, very.
All that experience and book learning, just lean in.
Exactly. As outlined in Podcasting for Dummies, the book upon which this entire show is based.
I didn't even read that. How was PsyCon?
I feel like I'm just wrapping up because there was like a real world mystery of why is water shooting out the back of my house?
More pressing and urgent things to attend to.
Yeah, so the plumber's here finishing that up. So that mystery turned out to be broken water pipe was the solution.
Mm. Oh, you came home to that or?
Yeah, that was great.
Wow.
It was nice, I thought. So Ben, how was did you have a good time?
The conference? Yeah, it was busy, but, you know, I gave a talk on mass hysterias, and then I did a investigations thing with Jim and Joe.
That's Jim Underdown and Joe Nickel?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, so.
Did you talk, Blake?
No, I didn't talk. I was there for free because of winning the costume contest the year before where I went as Occam Shaving Cream.
Still very clever.
It was funny. I thought, well, my gosh, we're really close to the Bell Witch historical site. I thought, would it be silly to come this far and not ride out there and at least take a look around? And
how close is that to Nashville?
It's probably like 35 miles and 50 minutes because it's a bunch of country roads. But I looked around for Joe to see if I could find him since he was there, and we couldn't. All right, I couldn't find him, and then Ben and I headed out, and we stopped at the state road sign marker for the Bell Witch, and then all of a sudden, this car whips across and parks in front of us, and it's Joe Nickel and Von Ries, having just left the site. So,
some kind of synchronicity.
Well, you know, it's not really what you'd call a coincidence. I mean, I guess they
I mean, or is it? I don't know. Is it? It seems like every time, you know, Joe makes a point when he travels to try to go see these kind of sites. And I think Ben and
don't
I
don't we all?
Exactly. Right. Everybody's so inclined. So I, you know, there's as I'm sure we'll talk about, there's not a lot to the story from a historical perspective, but the site does exist where the story takes place. So it was interesting.
Yeah, I saw the photograph on Facebook with Ben. Very nice. And why wasn't there one of you, Blake?
Oh, well, I never got it uploaded. I got a little distracted by the whole water thing. I'd gotten a call saying that there was a problem with the water at the home coming out of the back of the house. And I was just anxious to get back and find out what was going on. So
maybe it was because you visited the site.
My wife did mention that there was some mysterious voices the house had banging noise. No, she didn't.
And you were gone.
Apparently, it's not unusual to have water pipe breaks, you know, in our neighborhood. Apparently, we're sure. the plumber I'm working with, we're the fourth one he's had to fix in our neighborhood. So
you needed the taps guys out there.
Yes. I don't have a ghost, but I do have a plumbing problem. So. Yeah.
They're qualified for that much.
So we I thought this would be fun. I had my truck. Ben and I hopped in and drove out there. And it was a little – I don't want to disparage the place, but
like the Lincoln cabin,
it was a little sketchy. I mean, it's like
a little dicey.
The first thing you see when you get out there is this like a tow behind trailer, and there's a sign above it. This is psychic readings. And there's a guy who does psychic readings, and I don't think this was my imagination. He looked at me and Ben and then went back inside his trailer and closed the door.
Maybe he was psychic.
Yeah, maybe he was.
He could sense the negativity.
I don't know what happened there. And then we told him we were in kind of a hurry, which is totally true because Ben had a talk to get to. And the way the cabin is set up, first of all, it's not the original cabin. It is.
I was going to ask about that.
It's a replica cabin, and it looks really nice. You know, my family, my dad, part of what he does is build log cabins and restore them. So I appreciated some of the craftsmanship for the way it was put together, but it wasn't entirely authentic. It looked like the oak logs were, you know, properly chinked and everything, but the floors were, you know, kind of modern pressure treated wood floors. And
yeah, it was sort of a Disneyfied version of, you know,
if you
only kind of knew how roughly what it was like, then you could pull it off. But you know,
And then they had, you know, no animatronics or anything, but they had the pre-recorded audio that they played in various rooms of the cabin to tell you the story. And so as you kind of move through the different rooms, you stop, sit down, and listen to this audio. And it was, you know, I thought that was nicely done. In fact, if I had to rush home, in the evening they have candlelit tours, which would probably be genuinely creepy to hear that really well-produced audio and sitting in a dark cabin with the wind blowing outside. The weather was perfect for it. It was overcast and windy. Yeah, it was a good place for a ghost story. It began much like a traditional, I'd say a witch story more than a ghost story.
Right.
Because the senior Bell was out on his property and he sees this mysterious animal. It looks like it's part rabbit and part dog. And while that's kind of creepy, I think, in one sense, it's also very consistent with the kind of things that happen in European witch stories. People would see a mysterious animal. Usually it was something like a hare, and a hare does look something like a oversized rabbit. And then you find that you can't kill it. You shoot at it. You try to kill it, and you can't kill it. And that's one of the first signs that you're having witch problems.
Either that or you're a bad shot, right?
Yeah, well, maybe, you know.
So did he attempt to kill this creature?
I don't know. I have
That was in one version that I...
That's one of the, part of the problem. There's the book, and then there's lots of different folklore about it. I've read stories where they found a dead animal, and I've read stories where he saw a live animal. But that seems to be a consistent part of the story. The problem is, I hate to just jump to the conclusion, but there just doesn't seem to be a lot of facts to back up the story. The story is very elaborate, But the whole story seems to come from a book about the acts or the activities there that took place decades later. Like, was it 60 years later? So
yeah, it was like 60, 75 years later. I have the book in front of me, the Ingham version of the book. And I think it's worth reading the first few sentences because it's the preface, and it really sort of sets the stage for the whole thing. All right, the preface from the book. It says, "It is not the purpose of the writer to present a romance for the entertainment of lovers of fiction, nor to establish a theory to please the fancy of adherents to so-called theosophy, but simply to record evidence of historical fact sustained by a powerful array of incontrovertible evidence as it comes to hand, testifying to the most wonderful phenomena the world has any account of, a visitation known as the Bell Witch, believed at the time by many to have been of supernatural origin, which appeared in Robertson County, Tennessee, some 75 years ago, inflicting unendurable suffering on John Bell, the head of the family, and was said to have ended his life, and which also awakened a sensation that has lived through a generation." So that just struck me when I was reading the preface to it, because it's the very first line is saying, look, this is a true story. It was sustained by a, quote, powerful array of incontrovertible evidence, end quote. So I'm like, wow, this is – I would love to see a powerful array of incontrovertible evidence. And then, of course, the story goes on. But it's a very telling preface.
So there weren't any contemporary accounts?
No, not contemporary, but inside the story, it has there's a lot of letters from people who attest to the veracity of what has been told. But these are two. The problem is, and there's also a supposedly a diary from the son, but it doesn't matter because none of the original source material, including the diary, exists.
Right. I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, it's a typical, friend of a friend story. I mean, it's pure folklore through and through. You have this guy Martin Ingram who is sort of retelling what he heard from what he read about a handwritten diary by Richard Bell, who was one of John Bell's sons. From 60, 75 years earlier. And then, of course, as Blake noted, there were different incarnations of the story still. So, again, I've read probably at least a dozen different versions, and I'm sure there's many more. So it's interesting how, even different writers put their own little spins on it, and because the story is so old, dating back at least to the, to the 1800s, obviously, because that's when the book first came out. You've had well over a century to mangle the story and add details and do all those fun things that happens to folklore.
And so, with these letters, were they from eyewitnesses or family members or friends?
Right, they were from people who had they were eyewitnesses or people who had heard firsthand the stories of the events.
Right.
But we don't have those letters either. I mean, they only exist inside this book. So, Ben, I read your piece for a Skeptical Inquirer, and I'd also listened to Brian Dunning's episode that he did of Skeptoid talking about this. And of course, one of the big things is that inside the work of the Bell Witch book, it talks about like authenticating material that would have been contemporaneous, but that doesn't exist. Like, for example, they say that Andrew Jackson came, but
right.
But his travels are actually well documented. He wasn't in the area at the time.
Right.
And as Dunning points out, I think very nicely, that the election of Andrew Jackson to president was really contentious. People were really looking for anything to sling mud at the other guy, right? So both candidates were being really awful. If they could have said that Andrew Jackson had been bested by a ghost, I think that would have happened. You know.
In fact, the Andrew Jackson story is actually one of the more interesting parts of it. It's not just sort of mentioned briefly. It's given quite a few pages to it in some detail, and everything from direct quotes from from Jackson, addressing the ghost and the ghost addressing him back. It's rather detailed and melodramatic.
It's very exciting. I mean, he pulls up in his wagon, and all of a sudden the wagon won't go any further, and the mules are straining at it, and finally a voice comes out of thin air and tells him he may proceed. And then suddenly he can go stay at the cabin, and he has a horrible night there with banging and clatter and noises, and leaves the next day saying he'd rather face the British than face the ghost.
Right.
So, it's exciting.
This is something I've come across in a couple of other stories as well, with the Winchester Mystery House in San Jose, mm-hmm. That was owned by the Winchester family. Apparently, Teddy Roosevelt had paid a visit and was turned away by Sarah Winchester, and I think one of their rifles had been named after him. So I've just come across a couple of stories here and there where there's a president or a future president involved. And I guess that's just to add credibility to the story.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'd forgotten about that element of the Winchester House, but I think you're exactly right. I mean, it's what more credible eyewitness can you ask for than that? I mean, to this day, UFO proponents still harp on Carter's President Carter's alleged sighting of a UFO back in 70 something. So, yeah, I mean, go aim high, right?
Yeah, there's a haunted hotel in Santa Cruz called the Brookdale Lodge, and apparently I think Herbert Hoover visited there and saw a ghost as well. And he actually did visit; he was a guest at the hotel. But I don't think there's any evidence that he saw a ghost or made any claims about that. I think again, it's just trying to build some kind of credibility to the stories.
Mm. Yeah, I think having somebody reputable being involved does help. I think it. Casually, I think it'd be nicer if we had their firsthand accounts, which in these cases we don't because I don't think they exist. But what I thought was interesting about the Bell Witch case is it starts out and it sounds like a classic haunting or a poltergeist attack, much more than a witch attack once it gets going. There's banging on the walls. People are being poked and prodded. Dishes are flying around and breaking. So even as... I don't know a lot about pre-1900 poltergeist attacks. This sounds much more like a poltergeist attack in the way it's written. So,
well, this was sort of around the time or just after the witch crazes in Europe, wasn't it?
No, this is 18. Well, you mean that allegedly took place? Right? You mean so? There's the events took place in the very very early 1800s. But then the book's actually written in the 1894.
I mean, when the alleged events took place, that would have been around the time of the end of the witch craze. So I'm wondering if witch was an interpretation of the phenomena at that time.
That's actually interesting. In the book, they use a variety of terms. At one point, it's referred to as a goblin and a gnome and a gremlin and a witch and a ghost. I counted about
anything
a dozen.
Anything you want it to be.
Yeah, pretty much whatever you want. I mean, and which of course helps for the reader in terms of verisimilitude, because that way, if whatever Ingram is telling you, if it doesn't fit your conception of a witch or a ghost, well, if you believe in goblins or gremlins or fairies or whatever the hell you want, you can sort of say, well, okay, because it's given a variety of possible labels, that sort of gives you a bunch of different outs if you don't think that it really fits the characteristics of any one of them.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say kind of reminds me of Jeff the Talking Mongoose a bit,
it
too.
It does,
this
yes.
Cryptid poltergeist.
Yes.
That sort of changes in the way that people perceive it.
And it's interesting because, with Jeff the Talking Mongoose, we know that whether that was a real animal or not, or a real, it really took place. In other words, even though it was almost certainly a hoax, people really did write down contemporaneous records from multiple sources that they went there and heard strange things, right?
There were journalists who went there, and they even sent evidence to the British Zoological Society. So, not an urban legend as such.
Right, right. And in this case, it appears to have sprung, you know, fully formed from Ingram's imagination, because there doesn't seem to be, or at least there's no written record of these events that predates his book, which is a telling clue.
That's one thing that struck me, because I actually read the book on the plane back, and in fact I really recommend that, you know, just as part of a course of, you know, when possible, consulting the original source. Mm-hmm. If people are really interested in getting into the story, you know, you're much better off reading the original source, because we actually have it here, rather than, you know, any of the different variations. It's called Authenticated History of the Bell Witch and Other Stories of the World's Greatest Unexplained Phenomena by M.V. Ingram. And that's exactly right. I mean, as I was reading the book, I was taking notes on the plane and writing in the margins, and repeatedly it refers to all these experts that came from far and wide, the committees and, you know, Andrew Jackson, just everybody. And there's, you know, there's dozens and dozens, if not thousands, of people who were supposed to have been witness to this, either firsthand or secondhand, or heard about it whatever else. And where are they? I mean, if this really is a true story, you would think that, you know, that this is, you know, well known throughout the county, it says, and it lists all these people that came, detectives came, and yet there seems to be no written evidence written by anybody else anywhere that mentions this.
Yeah, in fact, the if you're interested, you can get the Kindle edition of this for 99 cents. So it's really well done. Plus, you can search it. So I find that extremely helpful when I'm doing research, is you can actually do a word search to find particular things within the text.
Naughty words.
Well, you could look for the word cave and find out why they've got a cave on the property that's inside a barn and costs $12 to visit.
Yeah, what is the connection of the cave?
Apparently, there's a story that Betsy Bell and some friends went into the cave, and while they were in the cave, a boy got stuck in a hole, and the witch pulled the boy out of the hole and then lectured the kids on the dangers of going into a cave.
Oh, so it was a good witch thing. No,
well, see, here's the thing. Intermittently in the story, the witch does good things and friendly things and then really bad things. And by the end, murder.
No, it's absolutely
like
remarkable.
Jeff too.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, I was reading the story, and, you know, the story has, and I use the word story advisedly, it has long passages of long conversations, very pleasant conversations. The Bell Witch gives the family gifts. They talk about matters of the day. They hang out. They chat. You know, and then in other parts, you know, the Bell Witch is making one of the daughters vomit up pins and needles. And it's just remarkable, you know, if this really is a true story, then it's amazing how bad the ghost communication has gotten over the past 150 years. There's, you know, again, pages and pages of direct quotes of, you know, clear language, you know, creative language, you know, all these sort of things. And these days we're reduced to EVPs. It's like, wow.
Yeah. Good points. Yeah.
So it creates this interesting distinction, especially if you're right about your hypothesis, Ben. We'll talk about that in just a second. You've got authentic ghost stories where people really believe they've seen a ghost. And then you've got ghost legends, word-of-mouth stories that are ostensibly based on true things but are really part of folklore, where the original person is never identified, or if they are identified, they never really took place the way it's claimed, or it's a friend of a friend. And then you've got fiction, which is given credibility by its use of real people. And which one of those three do you think this is, Ben?
I think this is fiction that's given credibility by the use of real people. And again, this is a this is certainly not unknown today. I mean, you know, you can't you know, go in a video store, rent a movie without, you know, some horror film routinely being claimed as being based on a true story or based on true events. And of course, there's been a couple films made adapted from this. But this is nothing new. You know, sometimes I talk to people who are like, oh, well, you know, this was written, you know, 100 years ago. It must be true. It's like, oh, okay. Yeah, because nobody, you know, nobody told falsehoods, or there was no sorts of Yale journalism or newspaper hoaxes, you know, 100, 200 years ago. But yeah, I mean, obviously, if you can use real places and real people, then that adds to the realism. And in fact, this actually reminded me quite a bit of my investigation into the White Witch of Rose Hall in Montego Bay, Jamaica, which I wrote about in a couple of places, including one of my books, where, you know, there was this whole elaborate ghost story based on ostensibly real people. They're, you know, real names that happened a long, long time ago. But when you look more closely at it, there's just simply nothing to it.
So in modern times, the people who did the Blair Witch Project actually based the idea of the Blair Witch Project after having heard the Bell Witch story. And in the way they presented the Blair Witch Project was as though it were a real event. It was a found footage.
Right.
And part of the story, although you could find the answer pretty readily on the internet, that was at a time when people still really didn't understand, you know, it wasn't as easy apparently, because lots of people didn't know if it was real or not and thought it was real. And in fact, the filmmakers still get contacted by, this disturbs me, police departments wondering what happened with the case.
Well, I saw a midnight screening of it in Sydney at the time when it came out, and it was presented in Australia at its release as being a true story. And so there was a lot of hype in media about that. But that was the way that everyone saw it there, at least to begin with.
So this your contention, Ben, is that this book is doing the same sort of thing. It's a fiction, but it's being presented as real to give it greater I want to say verisimilitude, but I don't want to say it incorrectly, because it's one of those words I read but don't say.
That sounds right. No,
like paradigm.
The paradigms and all those.
Exactly.
No, I think
there's a vast chasm between the words I know and the words I know how to say.
The ones he knows. No, I think that's exactly right. And the other thing to keep in mind is that unless you're writing some sort of you know, fantasy or science fiction that's really out there, you are sort of constrained to using real places. The most, you know, elaborate fiction novels of, you know, serial killers and monsters and whatever else are set, you know, here and now. War of the Worlds, the 1938 broadcast, was supposed to be going on, you know, on the East Coast in New York and New Jersey. It was, of course, adapted by Wells. But again, so, you know, in a way, it shouldn't surprise anybody that writers use what's around them, and they use real places, and sometimes they use real figures. That has nothing to do with whether or not the story is actually true or not.
I know they say write what you know, which is why all my stories are about fast food and masturbation.
Exactly.
<It is. laughs>
That won't make it
good. You should do a plug for your story.
Yeah, what's that?
You should do a plug for your story now, which I still haven't read. I'm looking
forward
to reading.
Well, I plugged it in the last episode, so okay. we're cool. Although, if you want to read an incredibly good story,
it's Halloween.
Go find Weird Tales and read my story.
What's the title of it?
I believe it's called The Thing in the Cellar.
Ooh.
It was originally called The Horror in the Cellar, but when they did a title search, they found that was already used. So.
Or they thought you meant Horror in the Cellar, right?
Right. It was autobiographical. It was about my experience raising money for my family by performing terrible, terrible acts in the basement for money.
Frankly, I'm more interested in that one. So if you could write that one, that'd be great.
Yeah, it's good stuff. The Kindle edition will be out later today.
Myth days, yeah.
Well, I have to say that when I was reading it, there's one particular phrase in the whole book that I really enjoyed, and it occurs on page 201 when they ask Uncle Zeke. He says it's great. I mean, it could have been ripped from you know, Ghost Hunters. He says it's because it's a Native American burial ground.
That explains everything.
Right. Well, there you go. We got an Indian burial ground. What else could it be? And it was just funny to see something written so long ago that, in many ways, the whole ghost hunting lore and vernacular and all that really hasn't changed much.
No.
Well, what was interesting when I was researching the Skeptical Inquiry article for SI, one of the first things I did, which apparently no one else did in terms of, certainly the ghostwriters, is I went back and looked at the folklore on it. In fact, there's quite a bit of folklore, and the Bell Witch story is identified as legend as far back as the 1930s. And it was discussed in, for example, the Journal of American Folklore in 1934. I found a couple references there, and I looked that up. So
now it's true.
Right. Well, there you go then. Right. It's sort of whitewash into the truth. It's not as if folklorists are unaware of this. In fact, folklorists have been writing about it for, 80 or more years. It's just that the ghost hunters and ghost investigators either haven't thought to look at the folklore research or just ignored it because they're just so convinced that it's a true story and not folklore.
Or have you gone onto YouTube and seen some of the very convincing evidence that these people have come up with?
I haven't. Can you summarize for us?
Orbs.
Oh, there you go.
Wow. And strange, inexplicable lights and voices, EVPs, of course. You know the drill. The usual stuff from today.
Not good enough. This folklore thing is funny because there's a... an old house north of where I live called Barnsley Gardens. It was the Barnsley family built this huge European-style estate built this elaborate European garden and brought in trees and fancy plants, fancy imported things. Anyway, beautiful place, but it went into ruin and became this sort of desolate, ruin with this what looks almost like a castle on the grounds, and ghost stories abounded, and a lot of them centered around this terrible feud some of the family members had over a particular girl, and there was a story about a poison duel, and anyway, beautiful story. But I had the occasion to read the actual history of the site in from the history of Bartow County. And like the stories I'd heard my whole life, these sort of romantic gothic love stories were just completely fabricated. Mm-hmm. And the real story is very interesting, but nothing to do with the ghost stories. That kind of thing happens. And I think these stories, as with all folklore, take on a life of their own and continue to evolve. So, there may still be versions of that story told, on the tours of the grounds, because I know they still talk about ghosts up there. Mm-hmm. But I imagine over the years, as people pass the stories along and different, people come and go, and those stories are going to continue to change. So
I think Bell Witch stories sound like a choose-your-own-adventure. There are just so many variations.
There are a lot of variations.
If you believe in orbs, go to page 5. If you don't believe orbs, go to page 13. If you think this is bullshit, go to the end of the book. If you believe it, buy another book.
So there's a movie, at least one movie, that there's actually three, I think, but one movie that got mainstream release, and that's An American Haunting that has Donald Sutherland and Sissy Spacek, I think. Mm-hmm.
Must be true.
Well, I don't. that story changes a lot of things, which annoyed some, ghost, paranormal people or people who like the paranormal. They like some authenticity in their story, but apparently the source materials.
Authenticity in their folklore.
Right. Well, I guess what I was going to say about it is the real claim to fame for that film, in my mind, is that it's the second film by the guy who directed the Dungeons and Dragons movie. Which was a huge disappointment, although it's the only film I remember that has a beholder in it.
That had Jeremy Irons in it, didn't it?
Did it ever, man? Yeah,
I like Jeremy Irons.
To watch Jeremy Irons chew up some scenery, man, that is the film to watch. he cranks it up to 11 in that movie. So, But it's a piece of crap, but it's very engaging. It's very fun to watch. So
engaging crap, yeah.
Yeah. So, but that's the Dungeons and Dragons movie. Not, I haven't watched The American Haunting yet. I have it. I'd kind of like to watch it this week since it seems very fresh in my mind. But you know, I think it's just kind of disappointing that what is widely touted as being one of the most best documented ghost cases in American history is only documented through fiction. That's just really sad.
Well, I mean,
to be expected.
Well, I mean, yeah, as you know, to my mind, the remarkable thing is just, you know, how often it's been written up as a true story. I mean, over and over and over again. Ghost writers, people write about ghosts, Brad Steiger, for example, and, you know, many others, they just repeat it and they just assume it's true. And there's no attempt to investigate. It's all just laid out there as if, well, this is the real deal. I have one particular section that I want to read from this book called, The Haunting of America, by William Burns and Joel Martin. Because again, it really crystallizes their argument. It says, this is on page 145, it says, "Was young Betsy the poltergeist agent whose own telekinetic energy caused some of the horrific activity in her family's home? Some researchers have theorized that Betsy, under emotional stress, may have acted out of some sort of subconscious resentment of her father that manifested itself in the form of psychic energy responsible for creating the poltergeist havoc. Skeptics blame Betsy, accusing her of fabricating the Bellwitch phenomena. However, no one has ever proved that, and Betsy never again spoke of her family's troubles." Now, there's so many things wrong when you're. It's like there. It's you to see. Skeptics blame Betsy, accusing her of fabricating the Bellwitch phenomena. It totally misses the point. It's like arguing whether or not, you know, Huckleberry Finn's father actually did beat him in the Mark Twain novel. Well, in the novel, yes, he beat him, but it's a fictional character. You can't take it out of the fictional context and ask these questions. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, it's a very modern theory about how that occurred.
Exactly.
The poltergeist. But it reminds me, again, I'm drawing lots of parallels, but I think we've talked about the Gyra ghost before, haven't we?
Briefly, mm-hmm.
Yeah, the place that's about 6 hours north of Sydney and was a poltergeist claim going back to the 1920s. And, I'm just drawing lots of parallels to that. And, again, it was a famous person who visited there. It was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Who'd gone to investigate the site, and it turned out it was a friend of his. It wasn't actually him. But again, you have the same young girl who is experiencing all of this phenomena, and then she's discredited in future. But this is a true story, not insofar as that it's a paranormal case, but insofar as that it actually occurred. Mm-hmm. And that it is well documented. So that's where it differs. But yeah, I think... this might be just a very early predecessor to all of these contemporary claims as well, and an explanation for a lot of contemporary claims, how they came about.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to know how many copies of this book got sold, because I know that the story is well known in Tennessee, but there seemed to be kind of a resurgence of interest when this, you know, American Haunting film came out, then everybody wanted to do a kind of a knockoff Bell Witch movie.
Right.
And, so, I don't know.
When Blair Witch came out as well, I think the two are feeding off each other for publicity.
Oh, I think so. And also the, that excerpt Ben just read reminds me of that most important thing. It's really easy to hear this case and go, oh, well, listen, you know, they had a teenage girl. Her name was Betsy. She was having trouble with a lover. There was a lot of stuff going on, you know. Easily she could have been hoaxing this whole thing and... this could have been just a case of her acting out, and that's a great explanation, you know, except for the part where you really need to check first to see if anything happened at all.
Right.
You know, you have to take the null hypothesis, you know. So I'd say that's more of a skeptic tactic than a skeptic.
Well, no, I mean, you're exactly right. I mean, it's you know, it's essentially, you know, you go back to Ray Hyman's categorical imperative, you know, where before you try to explain something, make sure that it actually happened. You know, before you start positing theories about what the ghost could have been, was it her psychic energies? Was it this? Was it that? Was it actually, you know, Native American burial grounds, as the old consequential darkie said? You know, what was this? Before you spend a lot of time and energy, you know, going to explanations, question your assumptions, question your premises, and say, well, is this true? Is this real? Before you go any further.
Oh, yeah. Very first step.
Yeah, there's a right inside the cave. There is allegedly an Indian burial ground. There's sort of a rectangular shaped box that appears to have collapsed. And in the legend, apparently, I guess at one point, the witch claims she's the ghost of someone who died, and the part of their skeleton or their tooth was under the house.
Yeah, there's this weird section where they spend like four or five pages, like this witch is pissed off because she's missing a tooth, and I'm like, go find a dentist. I don't know.
Leave me alone. It's really odd. But again, I've seen the picture of the Indian so-called Indian burial. Now my understanding was that the Cherokee, who would have been the predominant, you know, tribal presence in that region, did ground burials, and they did it usually like a day or two, or like either like the day of or right after the death.
Mm-hmm. In a box?
Well, no, I don't know if they used a box or not. You know, 1819 would have been, you know, and then this would have predated that, so this would have been probably the late 1700s. I'm not really sure if they buried in coffins or if they just buried in the ground, but I doubt they used coffins just because their burial beliefs, as I understand them, were that they understood that the body goes back to nature, mm-hmm. and that it makes sense to bury so that the, you know, body can feed the trees and the plants and, you know,
being in a cloth or something.
It's very circle of life, right? You know, so inside a cave, inside a stone box doesn't sound right. I actually reached out to Ken Fader, a friend of the show, to ask him about this. I sent him some documentation about the claims, and hopefully he'll get back. I don't know if he'll get back in time for this recording, but if not, I'll update the Facebook page or the show notes.
It's my understanding, just FYI, that he doesn't respond to emails unless you use the F word, so you might want to resend that.
Oh, don't worry, I did, yeah.
And by which I mean
Yeah. So I said, hey, Ken, I got a f-ing question if you have a f-ing minute. Then not too much of that, folks. I hate putting all those beeps in. So
you love it.
At least I got a beep this time.
So, yeah, I'm hoping, you know, my gut feeling, which is what most skeptics go by, right, is that this is probably not an Indian burial, that there's some other purpose for that box besides being the location of dead Indians. One thing I can't tell from the photo is how big the box is. And I know that while we were talking with Joe Nickel, he said he had some ideas about that box as well. So he may be writing something up. We'll see.
My guess, it was
an animal that was buried by the family or someone else.
Well, there was, I mean, there's nothing in the box. It just looks like it could be, you know, a trough for an animal, or it could be another, it could be a number of things. I don't know what it really is.
It could be an Indian dwarf.
It could be an Indian dwarf.
I like that explanation. Yeah.
Thank you.
It could be a storage box for a cave troll that used to live there.
Very possible.
It could be a feeding trough for chupacabra. Who knows?
That's right. We don't know. We don't know this.
We don't know. Let's just admit that. We don't know.
Right. We start with saying we don't know. Right. Anyway, I think that's the heart of this. So what can we learn from from the Bell Witch? What's a lesson for skeptics? Or for anybody who wants to, you know, investigate famous hauntings?
I think to keep looking for prior sources, to try and find an original source, and then to question that, and to not look at a lot of contemporary sources, and but yeah, to find the original one as best you can, and then to see if there's anything, any truth to that, any historical truth to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and also just to, you know, look at these things in context. I mean, if you read the book, if you read, you know, Ingram's book about the Bell Witch, it's clearly a novella. I mean, it's
one of the novellas.
It's Steve Novella, it's the long lost novella brother. But no, it's obviously a novel. I mean, it's got direct quoted dialogue. It's got drama. It's got being lost in a cave, which, of course, you know, Mark Twain wrote about in Tom Sawyer. I mean, this is it's got so many literary devices that to think or assume that this is somehow an accounting of documented historical fact is ridiculous. I mean, I don't know how you can read the book unless you're working backwards and you know for a fact that the Bellwitch case is true and this is evidence for it. If you're working forward from the evidence to the conclusion, you're going to say, well, hold on here. This is just patently absurd.
It would be interesting to go back and see if there were any reviews, contemporaneous reviews of his book, in the region,
That would be interesting.
Because that would be the kind of thing like, really? I never heard of this story, but it sounds fascinating. you would think that would be well known if that sort of legend was in your region. But we can't document negative evidence very well. We can search for it and say we can't find it, but it's really hard to say, too much about the fact that it's not there, right? So far, no one's found Betsy's, any written allegations that Betsy did anything. No one's found the diary that Williams Bell supposedly gave the author. Mm-hmm. There's nothing. And the letters that were supposedly sent to him, those don't seem to exist.
And it's also the stuff with Jackson. I mean,
Simply doesn't exist. There's so much stuff that doesn't exist that's enough to call it a fraud, in my opinion. But
But with what does exist are the stories of witches and goblins. Those were all popular beliefs of the time as well, and seem to have been reinterpreted for today.
True, and he mentions that in the book that as he points out in the intro, I'm not here to talk about theosophy or spiritualism or whether or not ghosts are real. I'm just going to tell you these facts, right?
A lot easier.
So he acknowledges, most people don't believe in ghosts, especially not in the daytime, right?
Right. Again, if you read, there's quite a bit of the Bible in there. There's, messages and we mentioned earlier about how in some cases the Bellwitch has this sort of this benign social control, the teaching kids not to do bad things. Again, that harkens back directly to like La Llorona, the evil witch that's, telling kids to keep out of the ditches for their own safety, or, don't go in the lake because don't go in the woods because boogeyman will get you, or the Bigfoot, or whatever else. So again, these are, if you're looking at it from a folkloric perspective, it's all the elements are there. I mean, it's crystal clear.
What's the message here?
messages, always do the right things. In fact, there's one section of the book where the Bellwitch actually punishes a lazy worker. There's a farmhand there who's not quite doing things up to snuff, and the Bellwitch comes and gives the bounder a good shaking, and from that day on, boy, he worked harder than ever, blah, 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 blah. So frankly, we need more of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. As our moral guidance, witches, right?
Exactly.
All right. Well, now I feel like we're just here to pee on ghost stories, and that's not quite right. So, I mean, I love ghost stories. I just I continue to have this problem where they're supposedly true. That's the thing. When people think that stories that are clearly made up or not clearly made up, but presented as true and are not true, and the perpetrator knows they're not true. Mm-hmm. Is it entirely for fun? Now people are making a business on it. I mean, there's quite literally a cottage industry of Bellwitch support. Oh,
yeah. T-shirts and cave tours and canoe tours and, there's lots of money to be made. And as Karen has pointed out before, the same thing with Bigfoot. You go into the Bigfoot country and there's Bigfoot burgers and Bigfoot cafes and T-shirts and stuff. And so there's definitely an element of, exploiting it for tourism.
Monster Talk.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Monster Talk. You heard myself, Blake Smith, and my co-hosts, Dr. Karen Stolzno and Benjamin Radford, discussing the historical paranormal case known as the Bellwitch. Monster Talk is produced with the help of Skeptic Magazine. If you like magazines, you should get one. The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. We have got some fantastic interviews lined up already for this year, so please stay tuned to Monster Talk in 2013. We got giant spiders and leaping strangers and so much more coming your way. Monster Talk theme music was by Pete Stealing Monkeys.
Did you know that you can now subscribe to Skeptic Magazine digitally? Just grab our free Skeptic Magazine app, currently compatible with iOS, Android, PC, Mac, Kindle Fire, Kindle Fire HD, and BlackBerry Playbook. Head over to skeptic.com/magazine/app to find out more, and download more of your favorite Skeptic content.